I'm Hugo Disler from Farming Secrets. We had the pleasure to both actually film, Helen and myself filmed Charlie Maslin's farm, and now we've got Charlie on the line to have a chat to us farmers, or to the farmers. I'm not a farmer. So, Charlie, you there, Charlie?
I am, Hugo.
Charlie, would you care to sort of briefly give a bit of a rundown of who you are and how you're farming and where your farm is and that sort of thing, so farmers get a bit of an idea as to what you're doing there?
Sure. We run a farm in the southern Monaro, south of Cooma. It's all basically undulating grazing country. We run sheep and cattle in roughly 50-50 proportions. We've made quite a few changes over the last couple of decades with the way we run the place. We've sort of changed to from a set stocking system to rotational grazing. We've done quite a lot of work on streams, and we've been involved with a couple of different groups with trying to refine our grazing techniques and also, I suppose, trying to run the place in a much more holistic manner. In that, it's a terrible word, overused all the time, but I guess that's the way we try to run it. And so I think that's probably everything else that was written in the letter of introduction, I think, sort of covers it all pretty well.
Yes, and Charlie, I did go through that Soils for Life case study, which is case study number 8, which is yours. It's extremely comprehensive, and we have sent that out to our farmers. So if the farmers haven't got that, they can just email Helen, and we will make it available for you as a download. Charlie, you've had quite a few awards. Like, we filmed you win the Guy Award, which is, what it stands for. It stands for
Green Innovation. Innovation.
Agricultural Award.
Yes.
Right. And then you've also been nominated as Carbon Cocky the year before, in 2012. Is that right?
That's right.
And Outcomes Australia, which is this report that we have got, is also using you as a case study.
That's right.
Right. So it's quite an extraordinary... quite extraordinary things that you've done. So can you just give us a bit of a rundown, the size of your property, and you are sort of elevated in the Monaro country?
The place, it's been in the family since 1911. We just celebrated 100 years just a year or so ago. It was originally sort of around about... 16,000 acres, and then it was halved. We sold as a settlement after the war, back to about 8,000 acres, and then we bought a couple of blocks back when not long after I came home, as a couple of thousand acres, so it's back up to about 10. And this month we're going to settle on another couple of thousand acres, which adjoins us, so it'll be up to about 12,000. Anything further?
No, that's fine, Charlie.
Yep.
Look, what we'll do, we'll straight away go into questions.
Yep.
And we have got Paul Wollaston on the line. So, Paul, you've got a question for Charlie. Can you sort of let's hear from you?
Yeah. Well, I've got a few actually, Hugo. But I suppose the first one should be: would it be convenient to come down here in March sometime, Charlie, and have a look?
That'd be fine, Paul. I'm sorry I couldn't see you when we were marking cars there before. I've got you on my list to give you a ring, so I'll speak to you after that about this. So, yeah, I've got your number sitting up there to ring, so that'll be fine. Nice to be good. Yep.
No, that'll be great.
I just want to clarify one thing. Charlie does not consult and go around to farms. Is that right, Charlie?
No, I don't, but I'm happy to see people if they're
Thank
keen
you.
To come. Yeah.
Paul, keep talking.
Righto, well, I'm having problems with a barber's pole at the moment.
Yep.
And I know, watching your DVD, that you can minimise that by soil grazing.
Yep.
And I just wonder, how many paddocks, or how long does a paddock need to be spelled?
Well, it depends a fair bit on that. A lot of years we've got away with just the one drench, and some years we could have got by without drenching at all. Just we monitor probably every 2 to 3 months with doing egg counts.
Yep.
But a year like last one, where you would have been similar to us, we had a pretty green spring, and then it sort of stayed pretty damp, or it continued to rain a bit through the summer. It was a bad season for worm control, and we had to sort of break the mould. Some of the years we drenched three times. The weaners, I think, we drenched three times. The weathers, we got away with just a couple. But it's one of those things you just have to monitor how it's going. But to answer the question, we sort of if you get a hot, dry summer, we usually try and drench a bit like the old drench plan. It sort of seemed to make pretty good sense where you'd give them all a clean-out drench sort of about, we do it about November, coming into the summer. Then if it stays dry, it usually, by the time you get, we have sort of somewhere between 10 and 15 paddocks in most rotations, and by the time they get back onto the original paddock prior to being drenched, the summer heat has usually done a pretty good job on what larvae are there, so they tend to get remain pretty clean, but it just depends on what happens with the way the season goes. If you get that hot, dry summer, it's terrible in some ways with fire control, but it's good in others for worm control.
Yeah, well, you can't win everything, can you?
You can't, no. But I think the secret to it is have you done drench resistance tests at all?
I haven't.
No? Well, that's probably one thing worth doing, because you'll find out what drenches are effective. And that way, you know, you could be using drenches that you may have resistance to. I think you have to have a 95% reduction in the worm count for a drench to be effective.
Yeah.
So it's definitely worth doing a drench resistance test. Pfizer, I think Novartis, some of the drench companies will come and do them for you, because it's in their interest to find out how effective the drenches are. And you need 60 sheep usually of control, and then 4 or 5 different drench groups. And you simply give them the drench, they do a worm count at the start, and a fortnight later they come back and do another worm count and just see what's there. So that'd be the first step, I'd say, to find out what drenches are effective. And then after that, you've really just got to play it by ear with just get a worm count done every now and then.
Righto. Yeah, I think I didn't ask the question properly, but how long does a paddock need to be spelled to minimise worms?
Well, I suppose we don't. That's been a byproduct of doing the rotation. We really don't spell them on the basis of getting rid of the worms. We sort of spell them on the basis of what the growth rate is of the paddock. And ideally, if it's growing quickly, you might be back in the spring, or if you get a good autumn, it might be growing quickly, and you know you can be back within 30 to 40 days whenever the plant's recovered.
But there's no set time limit.
Basically, it works. The slower the growth, if it's hot, dry summer, you slow down the rotation. Or if it's a cold winter and it's not growing much in winter, or it's drought, as soon as the rate of growth slows down, you slow down the rotation. And as the rate of growth of the plant increases, you can speed up the rotation.
Right. Yeah, because that sort of answered another question I was going to ask you. Like, in a good season, the grass would get too long for sheep, wouldn't it?
It does. Well, that's where we found that what we do is we're really sort of very flexible with the rotation of the animal. Sometimes if we're wanting to join years, they might be going ahead of the cattle, if the feed's short, they're getting the better feed. But in a year like this, we try and have a good mob of cattle running around in front of the sheep. A, to sort of knock down the pasture a bit, and also B, they work pretty well sort of as helping with worm control as well, because they say the cattle can reduce the worm burden quite a lot as well. So that's a side issue, but the main thing we do is have the cattle going around ahead to try and knock down stuff to get feed to a better length for sheep.
Do you
have cattle as well?
Oh, I've got a hat full, yeah, only about 100.
Yep.
Yep.
Anyway, they can still be used to good effect.
Yeah, well, I haven't been doing that, but...
Yep, okay.
How many mobs of sheep do you run, Charlie?
At the moment, we've got two mobs of weaners. There's a mob of crossbred lambs and a mob of merino lambs. There's about and we've got a handful of sale sheep in with those, just older sheep in with those to make them easier to move and to make it easier for water. So there's, there's 2,200 merino weaners in the mob with, I think, about 300 young ewes so that will be sold. So there's 2,500 in that lot. And with the crossbreds, we've got all our ewe hoggets to get them up to joining weight, the ones we'll keep in the flock. So there's about 700 ewe hoggets and 1,200 crossbreds, so there's 1,900 there. And then we've only got two other mobs, which are the two mobs of ewes. One's got about 2,300 older ewes in it, and the other mob with the crossbreds is about 1,300.
So they're all on the rotation?
They're all on the rotation. So we've got four mobs of sheep, basically. Our rams, of course, another mob of rams, they're just, there's a couple of little paddocks just around the shed, and there's probably about four or five paddocks that they move between around the sort of nearby. So we don't really count them as a mob, but in terms of the bigger mobs, we've got four mobs of sheep, and at the moment we've got four mobs of cattle as well.
Joining in times like that, you'd have to separate things, wouldn't you?
No, we don't. We just joined all the merinos in one mob. We've got one mob of ewes that we take that we join to, which used to be a stud, but we're not a stud anymore, but we breed our own rams.
So Paul's got another question for you. Are you ready for it?
Yes.
Cool. Charlie, what sort of season were you having when you started cell grazing?
We were having we'd been through a pretty ordinary period.
Similar to now?
What's that? Similar to now, no, much worse. I think it was about 96. 95, 96 were pretty ordinary years.
Yeah, they were.
And we started, it was in March, it might have been March 96 or March 97, and we were originally just going to do a trial. There's about 2,000 acres of the place on one side of the road and 8,000 on the other. And we were originally going to do a trial just in the 2,000 acres on one side of the road.
Yep.
And it rained. March is a pretty pivotal time to get rain when a couple of inches can do a lot of good. And so we just thought, if it's good enough for 2,000, it's good enough for a lot. So on the Monday, we just started putting mobs together.
Right.
So we started then. And to me, it was I'd thought about it probably for about a year before, and we worked out sort of roughly what we'd do. So it wasn't just sort of go in their boots and all without thinking about it. We planned it pretty well, but we just thought that if after a couple of months it hadn't worked, we could just put the mobs back up again and go back to where we were. There was no downside, really. So we decided on the Monday to put all the mobs together and just make a start and see how we go. And
you've done it ever since?
Well, pretty well. We do set stock just for lambing and calving.
Yeah.
I call that a sort of slow rotation, really, because it's in the middle of winter when it's a slow growth period. So we use probably about a third of the place where we just set stock them for lambing and calving. But we've still got mobs of young cattle and young sheep still slowly going around the rest of the place. But basically, sort of from July to the end of sort of September, they're in mobs lambing and calving. But then once we get to sort of we mark the calves, then we put all the cows back together again and join them in one or two mobs. So there's a mob of, I've got this year one mob of about 320 and another mob of about 150 or so together.
You don't have problems with inbreeding, Charlie?
No, not really. No, we sort of breed our own bulls and keep a reasonable... I get a few outside bulls in now and then, but no, I don't think we've had any problems with that. It seems to work pretty well, but then... with the sheep, we put all those together when we wean them in about the start of October.
Right. Well, I'm really looking forward to coming and seeing you in March, and I'll get off here and I'll let someone else have a...
That'll be good, Paul.
Thank you very much, Charlie.
Well,
okay.
Now, there's someone else on the line from Western Australia or South Australia. Do you want to ask a question? We've got someone who'd like to ask another question. Well, if you do, just just call out, because we have got quite a few other questions here, so we'll go into those. But if you do want to ask a question, please just butt in. Otherwise, we won't know that you want to ask a question. Charlie, we had a call from uh, a question from Neville Bond from Talbot, but that's sort of pretty well central Victoria, and he asks, he says, could you ask Charlie to talk about how he decides to move his stock to the next paddock? Is it the number of days or the length of the grass or anything else?
Yep, okay. Well, that, at the moment we're moving kind of stock out of a paddock that a few years ago we would have been very happy to be moving them into. So that it does change depending on the seasons, how with the length of the grass. So that's not the reason. The main, when we decide to move stock, if we've got say a couple of thousand acres in a one block that's a rotation, if there's 15 paddocks, we'll divide it up. Roughly, we'll work out roughly what we need the recovery time to be. If it's 90 days, 90 divided by 15 gives you sort of the average number of days per paddock, and then we just adjust that. Some people do it really scientifically, but we just adjust it roughly according to the size of the paddock. If all paddocks are the same size, it would be quite simple, same time in each paddock as they went, as they go around. But some paddocks are a bit bigger than others. Two paddocks might be the same size, and one might have improved pasture and one might have native pasture, so the improved one would carry stock for longer. So we do it pretty much, to answer the question, we work out roughly the time period we want to go around to get from paddock one right back round to paddock one, which is the total rest period that all those paddocks get. And then we just do it pretty much depending on how the feed's holding out and basically sort of based on the size of the paddock. So bigger paddocks get a few more days longer and smaller paddocks get a couple of days shorter. So it's really, the question really revolves around the length of the recovery period that you want. And some years when it gets droughty and feed gets shorter, you become much more aware, I guess, of what feed you have in front of you. And as you move around a cycle of paddocks, and if the you get back to paddock one and it hasn't grown, you haven't had any rain or it hasn't been through a growth period, that's when it becomes really critical that you can see that you really have to make a decision at that point as to whether you buy and feed or whether you adjust or whether you sell. And that to me is probably the biggest advantage of doing the rotation, where you can where you really adjust the numbers to suit the carrying capacity of the land.
Charlie, thank you for that. We've got
Yeah.
Well, I think it will. It's a written down question, so it makes sense to me. It seems to be quite an elaborate answer. I've got four questions from Bruce Davison from Candelo. I think I should read out all four of them because they probably overlap a little bit. Is that fair enough? And we can go back to them if you've...
Sure.
Okay. I'll read out the four questions. Do you run your sheep, cows and goats as one mob? First question. Second one, have you measured any change in performance of your cattle and sheep after introducing goats? Third question, what is your annual average stocking rate in DSEs to the hectare? And the fourth question is, what is your average pasture recovery period between grazing? Well, you've sort of answered the fourth question, I think.
That changes according to the growth period. The smallest we usually have is probably about 40 days of rest in a good growth time, and the longest is probably about 90 to 120 in a really dry or slow growing period.
Okay. Now, do you want to make the question again? Do you run your sheep, cows, and goats as one mob?
No, we don't. We usually keep them separately. Quite often, the sheep and the cattle are on a fairly they're in the rotation all the time. For those listening, I didn't mention before, we do run some goats as well. We've got probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of our DSEs run as goats. They came in as really a weed enterprise, and now they sort of provide a bit of income with the sale of meat. They're a cashmere boar cross lot of goats, but we still keep them as a weed enterprise, and they probably only they have an extremely slow rotation because there's probably only about half a dozen paddocks that we really run them in where we have problems. They're used for briars mostly, or the briars are really gone, and they came here for briars, but now they're just here really for thistle and other regrowth weed problems. And so they, the goats are really separate. They get 5 or 6 paddocks where they run, and then that's where they go. But the sheep and cattle, we usually run them separately. And most of the time, a year like this, as I was saying to Paul, we run the cattle ahead of the sheep. But some other years, if the feed's a bit shorter or we're wanting to boost the sheep prior to joining or something, the sheep might go through first. But we usually do run them separately. You do get problems around water points, especially, say, if it's hot like it is at the moment. The cattle will tend to crowd around a water point pretty and keep the sheep out. So we find it much simpler just to run them separately. You can, if it's a really fast-growing period, you can sort of have the, if you look at a clock, you can have the cattle at 12 o'clock and the sheep down at 6 o'clock. So you're effectively shortening the rest period. But then when you want to get the maximum rest, you have the cattle say at 12 o'clock and the sheep at 11 o'clock following around just directly behind them. So it does vary, but to answer the question, we do keep the sheep and cattle separate.
Right. Have you measured any change in performance of your cattle and sheep after introducing goats?
There's no real change in performance. I think probably there's no change in performance from the goats. I think there's probably change in performance as a result of the rotational grazing. We've noticed that our twinning rates with the ewes when we scan them is higher. I think that's probably due to sort of probably partly due to earlier weaning and partly due to probably better being able to match feed to get the ewes to join well. And a bit the same with cattle. We're able to sort of get our young heifers onto good feed in that August, September, October period prior to them being joined. And our conception rates of young heifers have risen sort of probably for about 80% to sort of, I think last year was a bit over 90. And so we've seen rise in conception. I think that's mainly due to diet and changes in grazing.
Okay, thank you. What is your annual average stocking rate in DSCs to the hectare? Look, if you don't want to answer that, just say so.
No, that's all right. No, we've at the moment it's about 4,000. Just I think it's, if you take out sort of laneways and bits of bush and stuff, there's about 4,200 hectares in the place, but the figure I've come up with taking the bush and waste country out is about just under 3,900. So if you said roughly 4,000, and at the moment we've got about 20,000 DSEs, so it's roughly 5 DSEs to the hectare.
That's a pretty accurate way to answer that question. Thank you. What's your average pasture recovery period between grazing? I think you've sort of covered that, haven't you? Haven't we?
Well, that varies on the growth rate of the about 50 days is probably the smallest we, 40 to 50, and then it goes out to when it gets dry to probably about 120.
Question from myself is that with the goats, what's the take to keep them in as far as fencing for them? Does it require anything different to that of sheep or so?
One bloke who's got a few nearby, he says the best thing to keep them in is have a gun, and when you see the one first one duck out under the fence, he shoots it. We don't, I don't do that.
I'd be joking.
A lot of paddocks they don't want to get out of. They're interesting animals. We've got a few sort of 1930s, 1940s plain wire fences, and they don't go through them. You can have another fence where it's a netting fence built 30 years ago, and there's a little roo hole underneath it, and they'll go under it. Wherever we have trouble, we just run a low live wire. You can cut steel posts into about half, and drive them into the ground. Just run a live wire about a foot off the fence and about a foot off the ground, and it's 100% effective with them. And once you get them trained to it, we've got one little paddock where we put our weaners in when we first wean them, and it's got good power all the way around it, and you hear them yelp a bit as they go up and give the fence a test out, and once they're trained to it, we don't have much problem with it. So I think the main thing is if you ever go to get goats, the first thing is don't just get 20, get a couple of hundred so you've got a reasonable number that you'll notice a difference with. And the other important thing is just to do a bit of fencing. If you've got one or two paddocks where you want to keep them for the weeds, just they'll usually try a fence on the low side. They won't try, but they'll usually test the ones on the upside. If they can go up a hill beyond the paddock where they are, they'll probably want to do that. So just a low live wire on that uphill fence. But electric fencing is extremely effective with them. And that's basically what we use.
Charlie, we had a question some time ago from Roy from Mount Gambier, and he's got the difficulties of changing from baling hay to that of the time it takes to put in the fence and the cost of putting in the fence. So I think he's got about 600 acres there. And what would be your recommendation, or what would be the sort of a way that you would encourage someone like Roy to start cell grazing? And he's got fence and a consideration of fencing and stock troughs. He's really knows about the system, but he just can't sort of organise himself. That's a rude word to say, but can't sort of. How would he actually start?
He had a hay system. Is there existing fencing there, or has he got to redo the fencing from scratch?
He has to do. He's got existing fencing, but he thinks that it's not going to apply to cell grazing in that they're too big.
Yep. Do you have any?
Yeah, I'm actually on the side here. Here you go.
Sorry.
I'm actually on the side here at the moment. Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm actually on the side here at the moment. Here you go.
Yeah. Well, look, fire away then, Roy.
Yeah. G'day there, Jim. At the moment, I've got big paddocks.
Yep.
And one's best part of 100 acres. And what I want to do, I want to split them up into small paddocks to do cell grazing.
Yep.
Yeah. The paddocks themselves, the fencing there is all right, just the fact that they're big paddocks and they want splitting up.
Okay. How many paddocks have you got so far?
One block where I want to start, I've got about, I'll say, best part of 10, but they're all different size paddocks.
Yep.
They range from about 100 acres down to about, there's a few little small ones there, probably about, a couple of acres sort of thing.
Yep, okay. And what animals are you wanting to run?
Sheep and cattle.
Yep.
And I have been thinking, because I got a horehound problem there,
yep.
And I have been thinking about running goats too.
Yep.
And now I'm on goats. When you're kidding, as they call it, when they're having kids,
yep.
Do you have them behind shelter or provide shelter for them or what?
No, we just kid them. We join them just the same as the sheep, just for 5 weeks, and then just kid them in. We used to kid them in a couple of really just totally treeless paddocks out in the open. A lot of the country here is just naturally treeless.
Right.
We've got some shelter country up the back with a bit of eucalypts.
Mm.
The last few years we had a bit of trouble with them. I don't know if you've got any eagles, but we had a lot of trouble with eagles when they were out in the open country.
Oh, right. Mm.
But in the shelter country, it doesn't seem to be much of a problem. But
right.
I think probably the secret to, not the secret, but one of the things that makes the grazing much easier is if you're wanting to have sort of three separate enterprises on a fairly small area, the more different enterprises you have, the more mobs you're going to have, and the more paddocks you're going to need. So if you can simplify the enterprises down, I nearly went all cattle here at one stage until sheep recovered a bit. And I was, to run a really simple show, just to run all cattle would be dead easy. You can just split up paddocks once they get trained with one wire. It becomes pretty simple. But we've sort of stuck to, we're now about 50-50 with the sheep and cattle. So if you had some country you wanted to run cattle on and you wanted to split it up, you can just do that with one wire, do the sort of the wagon wheel type fencing around a trough.
Are you
aware of that at all? Or?
Yeah, I am.
A bit of tape, the cattle can get pretty well trained to it. Would you be running cows or would you be just having dry stock or?
It'd be cows and calves, mate.
You'd probably need a couple of wires with the cows. I think we'd probably three wires. Yeah.
Right. But if it comes to running sheep, well, you'd probably need about at least three or four, wouldn't you?
Well, we've run. You can run dry sheep. Most of the fences we started off building. The first fences we built were three wire with two live and an earth in the middle. Then we changed to four wire with two live and two earth. And now we've changed to five wires, building the fences. And a lot of time when people start rotational grazing, they build fences with the posts 15, 20 metres apart and just a few wires. But we've gone around to building a bit more of a five-wire fences with two live ones, wires number two and four, and then the posts about six or 7 metres apart. And doing that, you can run ewes and lambs in them no problem. So if you're going to do it, if you're going to split them up and you're going to run ewes and lambs, we're going to have cows and calves, build the fence with a little bit more structure to it than really. And the other thing I'd really recommend is that the grazing for profit schools are really worthwhile.
I've done one of those schools.
You've done one of those? Okay, good. That's a great start where you meet a lot of other people. And I think the other thing that's really helpful is anyone else doing the rotational stuff near you that you know of?
There is some doing that techno grazing, as they call it, where they have one wire.
Yep.
And they have and divide up little parallel strips.
Yep.
I know there's one down the road doing that.
Yep. We've looked at that with doing bulls for abattoir for Cooper, and it's pretty. You might as well be a dairy farmer.
The only thing with that, I see you've got to have a portable sort of water supply for them.
I don't know. Well, that becomes really involved, and we've sort of avoided that. We've tried to sort of keep it reasonably simple. But if you can even look up some of the people you did the grazing course with that aren't too far away, and just the best thing to do is just go to someone's place, have your list of questions, and you know if you wanted to come here, you'd be welcome. Too far, but if there's people near somewhere, within an hour that are doing something similar, just ring them up and go and see them.
People are happy to talk about it.
That should give me a lot of confidence to get started, I think, was a couple of folks who are nearby who'd done the grazing for profit school, and all the questions I had, really they could answer them for me, and that gave me the impetus to want to give it a go. And you've got nothing to lose if you do give it a go. Stick your mobs together and start to run them around. If you have a problem with the water point, well, you've got whatever the rest period is to get that fixed up by the time the stock gets back to that water point, or a problem with the fencing or whatever, you can skip a paddock and move on to the next one, and you've got time to attend to it. So if it doesn't work out, split them back up and put them the way you were.
That's right,
downside.
No, it sounds a very good idea to me. Yeah, I think it's quite good. The biggest problem I found is just getting enough time to do all the fencing up and just to get it up and running.
Yep.
Too many other things need attention besides getting at that.
Yep.
Yeah. Another question I've got is back to the goats again.
Yep.
Have you had much experience with them on Horehand?
Yes, we have, yep. We originally sort of got them just for the briars, and they eradicated them in about 2 years. But our little nanny replacements, the female kids we get each year, we've got a paddock that used to be the camp of about a 3,000-acre paddock sort of in the 50s. And where that camp was, the whole top of the paddock was just Horehound in the all year, and Scotchies and Bathurst Spurs in the springtime. Now there's not a. I think we only stock it fairly lightly with the goats, or the paddock's probably about 180 acres, and we'd probably have 200 little kids in there, which are probably they're probably less than half a DSE. They don't really equate to much. But just having them there, the stock move through that paddock. The cattle and sheep will rotate them through that paddock while the goats are there. And the goats will just separate out from the rest of the mob when we move the sheep through there. So we set stock them for the year. And there's not a horehound plant or a thistle in there anymore, but it's probably been more due to getting the ground cover right and reducing the competition. But the goats have certainly done a good job.
So do they eat them all year round, or only when they go to seed, or what?
Well, the briars, they just eat whenever they seed them in the spring and summer when they're leafy. Things like Scotch thistles and nodding thistles, they eat those in preference. A lot of other thistles, they don't sort of eat anywhere near as much with that. They'll only eat those thistles just when they get a flower.
Oh, right, right.
And and the horehound, I'm not too sure. I think it's fairly well down. It's a bit like if you go to the smorgasbord, there'll be some things you'll put on your plate and some things you won't put on your plate. And if you put the goats into a paddock to eat horehound, if there's other stuff in the paddocks that's a bit higher up in the pecking order, they'll go for that first and they might touch the horehound. But the paddock that we've where we had the problem, they've certainly sort of they've certainly eaten it. And we didn't have any briars or anything in there. They would have eaten briars and blackberries are number one. There's quite a lot of info you can get through the MLA guides for goats, and it'll give you a list of all the pretty much the order of preference of plants they'll eat. And anyway, they've certainly done a good job on the horehound here. But I can't tell you what time of the year they eat it.
Right. What I was worried about, I just wondered if they ate it when the seed was formed, whether they just go through them and they finish up when they pass it out, or just finish up transferring it somewhere else. That obviously hasn't happened in your case, then.
No, it hasn't. No, but I think that's probably if they have passed the seed out. We've sort of certainly our ground cover when we started the rotational grazing was under 70%. We had about 30% bare ground, and now we're sort of up to sort of at the moment it's probably with a better season it's about 100. But most of the time now we're sort of well above 90% ground cover due to the rotation, and I think purely that fact alone, whether it's horehound, whether it's serrated tussock, whether it's thistles, that's been the biggest factor we've had in controlling weeds. And so even if the goats have spread the seed around, having very limited bare ground for the weeds to germinate is the best thing you can do to control them.
Oh, right. Yeah, that would help too, yeah.
The goats sort of, they'll eat the plants, but getting the ground cover up suppresses them being able to germinate.
So you've got a lot of your weeds down, like thistles and horehound and briars and that sort of thing. So what are your goats actually eating now?
Well, at the moment we've got one paddock down to the bottom end of the place where we're still the Scotch thistles still there's probably a couple of fairly big patches there that still appear on old camps each year. It's about the only paddock where we've got sort of a bad thistle problem. But most of we've just kept them going. They'll always eat. Sheep and cattle and a horse will always have their head down when they're eating. Goats will always eat with their head up in the air if they can. If there's something that's got a flower or seed head or stalk, they'll eat from the top and make their way down. So there's still that wild tobacco plant. They'll chew away at it. Any of the thistles about? We've got a bit of regrowth in some of the eucalypt country up at the back of the place. Trim it up a bit, but I suppose now we haven't sort of lifted their numbers because the weed problem's down, so they're somewhere between 5 and 10% of the DSEs, and they've come in as quite a handy sort of little form of income selling the kids off to the meat market. So they'll have 150 to 180% of kids each year.
Without
trying. If you get 100% out of the sheep, you're really thrilled. But if you get 150 out of the goats, you're disappointed. It's quite funny.
They're pretty
fertile, and they're really just there as a complementary enterprise. So there's still a couple of areas where they're handy in the spring with the thistles, but that's about it.
Yep. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Jim.
Right. Yeah.
Thanks for asking
another
question. I'll let somebody else ask some. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you,
Roy.
Yeah.
We will. The question I'd like to ask you, Charlie, is you've got as you saw in the DVD, you've got that lake or dam high up in the thing, and then you've got the water reticulating downhill. Now, and then you also explained that your dams are the levels are a bit low because the water's held in the soil. How expensive, not necessarily for your property, but how practical is it to have to rely on water being reticulated rather than dams, because the dams are sort of getting a bit low? So what's the considerations there for reticulating water instead of relying on dams?
Well, we sort of were at a point where we'd really run out of choices. We've got a fairly major creek system that runs through the place, and it'll stop flowing for periods of the 60s, 70s it flowed all the time, but then in the 80s and 90s it became pretty intermittent, but there's still quite big water holes in there. And in my father and my grandfather's day, as dams or became dry, they just opened up paddocks down to the creek. And when I first came home, we had in the early 80s, 79 to 82 drought, we had 3,000 acres of the place opened up down to sort of a couple of big water holes on the creek. And the damage that was doing to the creek area was just horrific, really. And the further you got back from the creek, the less grazing, the stock didn't walk too far. So we were really at a point then that I really had to look at doing something different to the way it had been done before, because the dams were a bit, they became dry in the drought, but then when it did rain after we changed our grazing, we really couldn't rely on them. Once you get the ground cover up, you really don't get the runoff. In lighter country, you'll still get the runoff, but in any of the heavier country, it just it doesn't run. So it became a we either could put a bore, we could pump out of the water holes in the creek, we could put a bore in, or we could try putting this dam in, which was fed by a spring fairly high up in the place. We were fortunate to have that flow of water up quite high, so that's why we built that dam there. And it cost about at the time we built it was about $40,000, and it cost about another $40,000 putting pipe and troughs in. That was probably over about 2 or 3 years, and we're able to that $40,000 we're able to water sort of probably about 6 or 7 thousand acres for trough water. So in doing that, it just took all the pressure off paddocks where we had either bad dams or a lot of the creek corridor. Now we've really fenced out and keeping stock out of it. And the sort of as far as the efficient use of water goes, the amount of water you use just in a trough is negligible compared to what you lose in seepage and evaporation and water being fouled in dams and things. So it was a necessity that came on through a pretty dry period. And I wanted to try and avoid the pumping thing if I could, but if you don't have that high source of water, well, it's either pumping from an aquifer underneath or pumping from a creek somewhere. So it's a matter of horses for courses, whatever is the best form to get water to your place.
So with a stipend group of farmers in central New South Wales, they do report that the dams have dryish or dry, and they resort to bore water. And they say that they're very happy to have their dams dry. So that then it's a good sign that things are working well.
That's right.
And people are doing grazing like your method. So it's sort of cost efficient to put in the effort into reticulating your water around the property.
It is, yep. And even if you have one good reliable dam has a good spring feeding it, that's quite low down, it doesn't take much just to fence it out and keep the stock out of it, and even just put a smallish solar pump or some, if it's not near electricity, just pump up to a tank on a hill and just reticulate from that, and just purely just keeping the stock out of that water, it just improves the water quality to bilio. And I think I saw some of the figures in Canada, I think, where they monitored the gain of cattle in paddocks, some on dam waters and some on troughs. And I think the rate of gain of cattle on good water was about 30% better than that on poor water.
I believe that our farmers are listening to that, because that's clean water is imperative, but you just sort of had given a very good example there. So if you'd like to expand on that, I think it's a very good point to sort of make clear.
Well, as far as the amount of forage that they can digest, I don't know exactly what the correlation is, but this study I did see was the rates of gain were about 30% better. So it might seem there's a bit of capital outlay initially in changing the water system, but I think but in the long term, the gains you get out of it will be well and truly worthwhile. The other thing that we've found, when you do the rotational grazing and if a mob of stock are out of a paddock for a couple of months, a lot of the time you'll get a lot of slime over the troughs and they look pretty terrible. We just chuck in a couple of goldfishes, three or four goldfish into each trough, and they keep the water clean. So that's another trick worth considering if you find you get that water problem. We had one bigger round trough, and we put in half a dozen in there, and they bred like steam in there. We end up having 200 or 300, so we just fished them out of there and put those into all the other troughs, and they certainly keep the water clean. So that's a trick worth considering to also help with the water if you haven't got stock in a paddock all the time. It will get frog blanket and stuff on it, and a few goldfish seem to do the trick.
Fantastic. And if you get too many goldfish, you have to sort of thin out the population, or they sort of thin themselves out through because they're a bit crowded and haven't got enough feed?
They'll thin themselves out. A couple of troughs, we've just got two or three big ones that are about 6 or 8 inches long. And some of the other troughs, they just sort of seem to, there might be half a dozen that are just 2 or 3 inches long. It varies, but as long as even in hot temperatures like now, where you need a bit of the trough covered where the float valve is and the water's cooler in there, they seem to survive all right. We haven't really lost them, but it surprises me with the temperature of the water must rise quite a bit. But as long as you've got a shady area somewhere in the trough, they seem to survive all right.
Well, that's a very, very valuable comment what you've made about the goldfish. Charlie, if anyone wants to ask another question, please do so, and then we'll go back to some of the general questions for Charlie. Okay, if you do, just please call out, and that's the best way. Charlie, when we filmed you and your mother and father, the whole family were very pleased, and it's reasonably unusual for farm on a farm where the farmers are more pleased. I won't use the word stressed, and I won't. There's a degree of satisfaction on your farm, and Helen was at Manly in Sydney, and she saw one of your sculptures there. So would you like to have a bit of a chat about what you do with your work like that? Because I think it's absolutely fascinating to me that a farmer can do that sort of thing. Is that appropriate for you to talk about that, Charlie, or have I said something that's not appropriate?
No. Well, some people go and play golf and some play tennis and whatever. I suppose I'd love to sort of you find some old rusty gudgeon or a few old horseshoes or something, and rather than just sort of chuck them in the rubbish tip, I sort of enjoy thinking of somewhere to go for them. So I sort of make bits and pieces of assorted rubbish out of them, and that might have been one of the ones that Helen saw. But it's just one of those things I enjoy. Just bits and pieces of old metal that are probably 100 odd years old, and it's good to see them come back to life and be useful for something. And
you've done a little bit of stone walling as well around the house.
Yeah.
You've done that quite artistically.
Oh, no, anyway, it's just whatever. Just something you do occasionally. It gives you a bit of pleasure. I think you need things, especially I find it when seasons are good, you can keep your spirits up pretty well. But when times get tough and it's a bit droughty and things, it's good to have some form of distraction. Go and build a wall or something that gives you pleasure. Maybe carving rocks doesn't give much pleasure, but to build a wall and just do something that when it's droughty you can see all the good stones in the paddock that you can pick up and use the wall. So it's just, just distracting you from the mundane stuff for something that gives you a bit of enjoyment.
Yes, well, look, thank you very much, Charlie, for bringing that up. And when we did talk, when the farmers will see on the video that both your mother, Anne, and father, Jim, were very happy with how things are going. And I think it's an absolute pleasure that a family can get so much enjoyment out of a property rather than seeing it as hard work or whatever.
Yeah, I suppose it was, the succession's always a difficult thing, and when my father and I changed over, it certainly wasn't a an easy, seamless changeover. But I think it's good to sort of, if, you know, when someone comes back to the land to join you in a place, I think a lot of the time things aren't really spelt out as to how things are going to work. And I think if that person comes back and they can have some value that they can add to the place in one form or another from their previous work experiences or whatever. But I think also just, it's really important to sit down to talk about the how it's all going to work, because most of the time I don't think that happens, which makes it pretty tricky. But anyway, I've been very fortunate with my parents. We get on well together, and there might have been a difficult few years there when the changeover happened, but it's all worked out well since.
Well, they exuded a lot of happiness, which is great to see. Charlie, one question I'll ask is that quite often farmers, when I talk about a rotational grazing, cell grazing, whatever you like to call it, they said, oh, yeah, it works in that area, or works in that part of Australia, but not in my country. So what's your answer to that particular statement?
Well, I think it really works. I think it really works anywhere, and probably in a way, the more brittle the environment, in terms of if you leave stock on a bit of country for too long, some really resilient parts, you can leave mob of rams in the paddock all the time, and the paddock will, if it's good soil and it's got good rainfall, the paddock will hold it. But I think sort of the more brittle the environment becomes, the more it's important that country gets rest. It's really interesting that one extreme, there's a book called Courtney White has written it about the national parks in America, and he was observing that he was a total greenie who hated farmers, and he was going around recording what was in all the national parks in the arid areas of the states, and he came to the observation that some of the national parks were in a lot worse condition in terms of species diversity and ground covers compared to the land that was managed well next door. And so I think sort of animals in the landscape are important, but I think the management of those animals is also really important. And I don't think there's probably really an environment that doesn't suit the rotation of stock. If you look at dairy farmers that run some of the really highest production country, and really high fertiliser, high water, high pasture output, they're probably the most intensive rotational graziers you'll find. You find a bloke out at Alice Springs running cattle on really dry country. If it's well run, the rest needs to be longer because the plants take so much more to recover. I think it's good to the country. So to me, it's animals in the wild, as Alan Savory noted in Zimbabwe and in Africa, went around the big mobs. That's where the whole concept he got for rotational grazing. And to me, it makes sense that plants need time to recover. It's not about the animal, it's about the plant. And if you let the plant recover before it's eaten again, it's going to be much healthier. It gets deeper roots, and you'll end up with much more perennial based pastures.
Charlie, thank you very much for that answer. Charlie, we're going to wind up this thing, so I'm going to wind up and thank all the farmers who have been online, and also thank the farmers who will be listening to this as a CD. Farmers listen to these CDs sometimes, six times over. They are very pleased with them. So I'd like to say goodbye. Now, Charlie, what have you got something you'd like to say on a parting note?
Well, thanks, Hugo. Now, thank you to all those who had questions and were interested to call in tonight. If I can be of any assistance to anyone, if you've got other issues that come up, my email address is on the Soil for Life website, and I'd be only too happy to answer questions, or not answer questions, but provide possibilities for you. I'm still going through the learning process, so I'll be probably asking you as many questions as you ask me, but I'm only too happy to share my experience with anyone. If that helps, I'll be seeing Paul probably in March, but if anyone's got any questions or they're coming through here, I'd be only too happy to to talk about what we do. You can make your own mind up about how you think your place is best run for you. That's the important thing.
Charlie, thank you very, very much for saying what you had to say. And on that note, and I think it's also very generous of you to make that offer to farmers to make contact with you. So not that we find the farmers do too much contacting with amongst each other, but I think that's a very, very generous of you to say that.
Well, there's a couple of farmers who helped me get started, and I really, they helped me on the way. So if I can help someone else on the way, that'd be a good thing.
It just makes farming a more pleasurable thing for the whole community, doesn't it?
It does, yep.
It does. Well, thank you very much, Charlie. We're going to wind up.
Yep.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay,
bye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.